good segue into this show.
Thanks, Andrew.
Like a radio presenter.
Yeah. it is something that goes to the heart of that problem for me. Not even a problem, but that you know, all those received histories and how they sort of relate to each other. And, you know, when we think about it, almost a cohesive experience, and your perhaps attempt to derail that in this installation, I tend to think of the difficulties of still wanting a pure experience, still wanting a perhaps a singular experience.
Yeah, I don't think this show offers that.
No?
No, I think it kind of, maybe in some ways it's still quite graphic, you know, because it deals with these surfaces that are essentially flat, you know, objects in relationship to it. But there's a strong graphic, almost painterly sort of element to the way the space is dealt with, which I'm still quite perplexed about. It's not so much that's been kind of previously or a way that I would configure a space. But it's interesting, it brings up a different type of engagement somehow.
I actually see it as really performative, actually, because there's the act of looking that's really intense. And so I've only been in here by myself. And so there's, first of all, there's the mythology behind the show, so you've kind of, you've got some idea of what's coming, but no idea at all as well. So I knew that there was going to be black glass wall, and the wall was going to be closed, and that was it. So I was actually thinking I was coming into a very minimal show. And so there's this disruption of that, but there's also just the act of seeing myself but not really seeing myself in the reflection, and imagining a full crowd and hear an opening light, and that being a different, like, it's almost an abandoned space, and then going over there and there's this looking, like, what is that? And so to me it's not just a stand back, and that you have to actually go in, and then you get confronted by this structure that is, you know, it's like, what is that? You know, so there's a little bit, like, I think there's more than just surfaces going on, much more than surfaces. And also because it's the title, you're looking for what is the missing, the missing viewers that we hear on opening night, or the missing reflection, or the missing bit that's behind there, or, you know.
Certainly while you're sort of addressing constant shifting expectation.
Which I think, that's what I mean by it becomes much more of an experience because of that. It's because of the layering of the materials as well. So you've got the black glass, and you've got this object. What is that object? And you go over there, you're like constantly trying to work it out. So you have to be present to work it out. You can't just look at it and go, oh, I get it, and we're good.
Do you think you ever come to a working out? Because that's where I find myself with this work. Like, if I come upon, I'm still curious about what it's really communicating. Like, I'm still intrigued by trying to address that interpretation. Because things seem to, one thing seems to disrupt the other in terms of a clear and unified sort of experience. And I'm kind of still perplexed by that and unsure about it, but also still interested in the work because of it, because I'm still trying to address that space within it.
Yeah, it seems that both of your practices maybe not address that space, but a sort of in and out of that space. And if I think of, say, edging still, that West Space all those years ago, and Stephen, the work that you had at your at your doctorate show, the contact sheet. Edging just seemed to be so much about the inability to, you know, break through the surface, you know, holding up the surface as something that is almost a testament to staying on one side. Whereas the contact sheet just went, bang, this is it. this is your desire consummated. This is the surface. Look at it with all its fallibility and even ridiculousness. So I love those two sort of polarities in a way. And I see both of those, I guess, sort of quite nebulous types of being in the middle in this show. It doesn't consummate what, whether we're on one side of the surface or the other, it just plays with that.
Is this the show that was in Bird Girl? The smearing of the makeup?
No, that was Simon, was at Westface. And when I look back on Edgy, still I don't ever show any of those images.
Really?
Because I felt like there was kind of too many signifiers. Like I felt like it was too... Yeah, I would strip it back.
That's really funny because they're the shots I used to show when I... If I ever had to do a presentation on Westface, they were in my, those shots were in my group of like 12, 10 or 12. It's the breadth of practice that kind of happened. But it's interesting.
But the reason I bring it up is because it reminds me closely of the lack of consummation that's going on. Mm. That sort of, you know, dangling. I felt more so than, say, some of the other shows that were after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, there's a few things in what people have said that I wanted to pick up on because they're kind of words that have been floating out around in my head. Kate, you were mentioning your thinking about it in terms of being quite graphic. And I think part of how I think it is, and partly it is because it sets up these quite interesting pictorial planes. When you walk into the gallery, you're kind of situated between these, firstly, these two planes that are quite different in terms of their tonalities and colour and depth. And you're kind of situated in a no man's land, like some zone between them, where there's, and your relationship to though what's going on in each of them changes as you move through the gallery and you're asked to move kind of further or closer. And if you sit in this middle that you kind of just end up in when you walk around the corner and try to get some bearing, because there's no work that, and even no light that joins the two planes together, you're kind of asked to go towards one or the other and appraise each of them separately. Like literally you can't look at one and the other in a complete form at the same time. So there's that really interesting relation, that this thing that changes as you kind of situate yourself in, you're asked to situate yourself between them. And one of the things that really changes is that they're both there are different, completely different sets of signifiers floating around on each. The only thing that kind of seems to be similar between them is, you know, the kind of this, you know, S&M black rubber subcultural signifier on one wall, and the other, you know, the pink and the mirror ball-esque finish on the other. So there's these kind of things, but they're also not in forms that and not situated in the gallery in ways that you would normally be asked to kind of look at them and engage with them or walk around them. So you kind of, all as soon as you walk in here, you're very much you're not within it. It's not necessarily experiential. Mm-hmm. It's only experiential as you kind of move in and negotiate both, you know, graphically what's happening on site, but also in terms of the content that might be happening within them. You know, and even the rupture and surface of the both opposing walls are so just completely, you know, at odds in their approach that, and they can't, and they're not asked to be read together, they're kind of almost asked to be read in opposition or you know, as alternates.
But then once they,
because often people say, is one of your Stephen, or is one of these Stephens, and is this Kate, or which ones? They read it as two works that have actually been brought together almost as a kind of face off. Which I went, no, but it does actually light in terms of thinking that that's a possibility. It could be a collaboration that does that.
I think what's interesting in terms of the outcome is the binary condition, like within the work but also within the space, and maybe within the collaboration as well, that it wasn't a point of opposition, but there was always a point of distinction. And a type of
dialectic. But what's interesting within that is that they are tied to one another, because going back to, you know, another word that Adrian's mentioned a few times, language, for me they are they're using the same language, both sections. They're not different approaches, they're actually utilising the same language and language pattern and scales and timbre and speed and all those things.
Strong reference to painting is a language.
Yeah, but they're muttering or saying different things, you know, and that's the kind of interesting, that's the dialectic thing. They're really bound, but they're kind of seem to be presenting something that's tied together, both, you know, as I said, within signifiers that float in each, but also with their kind of approaches to saying it or something.
There's some disconnect between looking and reading. That's what I've found with that. You sort of look, you're compelled by the image, and then you re-look, or you look somewhere else, and you're compelled by that image, or even the deep image of yourself being reflected. But then the reading comes in, you know, then you're trying to think, okay, what does this mean as a, if I see that and then I see that. And then other things come in, like, okay, well, everything seems to be planar, but I'm stuck in this volume of space. But how are those arts activating, you know, volume?
But I saw it as actually being in the middle of it. Like, once you've actually seen both of it, then all of a sudden they come together and you're in the middle. That's the point.
And maybe that's where your point of the performative is.
And that's where you are. And all of a sudden you're in this space that something's happened and you don't know what it is, and you're trying to figure it out, and you're in the aftermath of this violent action, and there's this stillness, and you're going, okay, what is that? And all of a sudden you're here, you know, in it. So you're not in it when you first walk in, but you become in it once they've collided.
Was it an intention to use, say, the viewer as a performative element in a way that, I mean, obviously Wayfinder comes to mind as a sort of a reference point for using the viewer as a performance. A performer, sorry.
Yeah, I wasn't as conscious of it. Like, I think with Wayfinder, I was really conscious of how the viewer navigate the space. Was this, I think, because
we had discussions that the viewer was an echo.
An echo?
Or
rather than an activator.
The a participant, like, no doubt, but a type of echo of the initial action in terms of the work and what that was becoming, that sort of move we talked about as a type of binary movement between an activity, say, on that side of the wall and someone looking at themselves in that class or whatever. That it's, the work was constructed, I suppose, as a way that would allow participants to navigate that tracery because it pushed from one side to the other. So I think it was, it wasn't intentional, but there was always a sense that somehow, as viewers, we became an echo of the initial, I think, idea of the activity of that.
But I think initially the black rubber was going to be a floater, and it was going to just be a kind of a way of triangulating. And when you get the object and you situate it, and it's like, oh, well, this doesn't actually, I
make sense.
But yeah, kind of got lost, and then when you took it back to the wall, something else started to happen. So it pushed the work into a different direction at that point.
It disrupted the
dynamics of a spatial kind of engagement or a sense of identifying with that as a kind of figurative object. Part of, you know, each figure or each body that enters the space became something that drops into that black void, black mirror, you know, a reflected space that absorbs.
But also
its tactility,
registers
as well in that way. So these are kind of decisions that get made in situ, and really the work came together.
On the last body.
It did, and there was a, that point where the decisions were made very immediately, you know, under a lot of pressure, you know, because of the time. And you kind of have to hold with those types of decisions. You have to kind of commit to them.
The options were always there.
We kept it floating for as long as we possibly could.
I think this also comes down to materiality, though, because I imagine if this was a polished, highly polished concrete floor, or if it was a white tiled floor, then it could sit in this space and disrupt it in the same way that it disrupts the tiles, and then it could actually still be part of those two binary things. It's the wooden floor that doesn't allow this language to come together. You know, I can imagine that it would float in a different space more easily as well.
With Wavefinder, you use that sort of disjunction between the two spaces to, as a viewer, you're aware of your role. Not at first, but by the time you pass through the threshold onto the other side, into the second back room, you're aware of your role in activating the work. Whereas this emphasises the disjunction that we're talking about, rather than lures you into crossing it so you understand your role.
Yeah,
it's interesting that you use the word navigate. Well, that was my experience, yeah. The navigation is a little more ambiguous.
I think in some ways that's the strength of this.
Sure, I'm sort of negative.
Because I still really, looking back on life, I just really love that show. But I think not knowing how to negotiate that space and not being so aware, but still feeling kind of like you're trying to deal with something is part of what's really interesting about this show. And earlier when I mentioned I'm still perplexed by it, I'm still kind of having my own battle with it. It's kind of, in some ways, a really fantastic thing because it's still holding me, but I don't exactly know what my place within it is. And perhaps that's partly to do with the collaborative experience and not having complete control or ownership over things in the way that I've been used to for some time now. But, you know, being so self-conscious or building in that sense of how a viewer starts to become conscious of their own journey or navigation can also create a kind of an expectation that's very difficult to disrupt or agitate in a different way. Whereas this work, I don't know, it's still kind of, there's something, there's a kind of, I hit a block with it at times and then I fold back into it and then I'm engaged by it and I'm just not sure, and I think all of those things are actually part of what's holding it for me. You know,
it makes you realise how strategic viewer navigation can be in a lot of exhibitions that we see. Not that I spy on people, but
found a conversation.
People walk in and they sort of do this circle and they go.
But you can hear, you don't even have to watch them, you can hear where they stop and you know where they're going, and you've seen a few people.
That's really interesting. When I was seeing the show, I was really alert to that as well. I hear them come in and stop about there.
Yeah.
And then they'd either go there or they would go there. There's a choice then,
but they kind of repel them from both sides.
It's interesting because they usually stop as soon as they turn from minding the show, they stop actually right there.
Yeah.
And go,
where do I go?
Yeah,
what am I
it's almost a recoil. Like, it's not as a repulsion, but it's that sense of they're immediately confronted. And not with anything difficult, but just with this, I think there's a type of hyper sense within it, because I think it's lurid in that colour and the sort of gash. It's sort of there's something so obvious in that.
But it's like you're making them make a choice that they don't like the option.
But then they want to go around the corner and into the office.
No, exactly.
So they can get around the back.
And they are confused by the space changing and they're not sure if it's everything or.
Yeah. Can we go
through
there?
There is that real sense of things that a lot of what is happening in the show is happening in places they can't get to. You know, like they can't get to the other side of that wall, they can't get to the other side of what's going on in there, and so there is that sense of kind of you're left in this void. And you know, when you were talking about it earlier, Friday, I was thinking of, you know, a terrible Jennifer Lopez film that's called The Cell.
Oh, sorry?
Something really specific about it. Is it called The Cell or something like that? Or the something? It's a science fiction film anyway. There's a series of rooms or something. She goes into somebody's mind. And anyway, but what's really interesting is that transportative thing where you kind of end up in this place and the places that you know, that things are happening in places outside this room or on the peripheries or edges that you can't get to. It's about then navigating where to next. It's like it is comes back to that movement across this blank expanse because there's nothing to anchor one into the centre.
But you end up imagining, you end up, like, for me, I was bringing the two together in my head. So this wasn't a void anymore.
Yeah.
It became a field that allowed the two to communicate and be the same space. So all of a sudden I'm in this, you know, it sort of felt like an underground nightclub where something had happened that was really, you know, like there was a whole heap of theatrical things going on in my head that was halfway between both.
Well,
so the wooden floor disappears and the void becomes activated through imagining how these two worlds come together.
Yeah, but there is something, like when you talk about being on the edge of something, that is that kind of space of desire, which is always operating within my world quite palpably. But also with this, I'm not sure whether as a viewer I feel quite on that edge of the desire of space or just flaccid. Do you know what I mean? Because there's something about that object that's really flaccid. There's something about the strength of the graphic strength, the peak that's beyond the screen, that's far, far heightened beyond screen, but you're kind of like, how do you then, so theatrical to a point, then it makes you feel like you're sitting in the chair in a theatre, you know, there's a sort of sense of a passivity in relationship to it. It's quite different to, but operational within desire as well, and so I think the way those two things come together, strange in this world.
But I would kind of suggest that all of the, you know, of the many clashing but also interlinked reference and signifiers that are, you know, situated in different parts of this field, as Brady said, all kind of have a clear, very clear connection to desire, and they're played out and the way they are played out in a whole bunch of different ways, but a lot of them aren't necessarily, some of them aren't necessarily things that one imagines together, although they do exist, like, you know, passion and tenderness with violence and S&M, you know, things that are kind of floating around those notions of desire, but that are kind of you know, that are operating in sort of different frequencies, or we come, you know.
And they're not passive. No, like, I'm surprised when you say it's armchair, because no, I don't see this armchair.
Your sense is more, you're more, being more sensitive than I am. I guess I'm sort of calling it at its gross ends. But yeah, I'm quite interested in that idea of S and M and the spooning moment.
But I don't think those conditions are sublimated within this work at all. Like, in terms of there's no deferral here, but there's a type of, I don't know, maybe it's not the right word, but like a language of option, where I keep on thinking that there's a sort of oscillation between not just those, but the conditions of interpretation, when people have that question of what is this, and then the flurry of, oh, it looks like this, or it feels like this, or maybe it's that, but it's always nothing but everything. And I think that's quite interesting, is that sort of action that happens when, and I still have that action, because I feel bewildered by the work. Yeah, absolutely.
I think we all do.
No, I'm so bewildered by the work. I don't know how to, I don't know how to read it.
I was nervous about even having this chronicled, but I don't have a clear, I can't give you the face.
Can I say something?
I don't think that matters, though. I think that's part of doing shows with people that you know. Collaborations are really intense. They're really intense. Yeah. And your practices are so different. Mm. So to come together, I had no idea what it was going to be. Exactly. And so it becomes this, and then you deconstruct it, and then you understand. How can you possibly know beforehand? I don't think it needs to be known. That's part of it.
Well, I think there's a condition of the felt, in the sense that there is something, because I think of it's a type of material fetish that it's operating within the work, that there's a viscerality that I feel in the work, in terms of both as a reflected surface or an absorbing surface or a penetrating surface, that those things, those patterns are internalized, and I understand them, I suppose, within those terms.
That's
more so than a cognitive understanding.
Yeah. That's where our practices are actually linked, in that we both see our body as a material.
Mm. Yeah, as the first sort of point.
The first materiality.
Yeah.
So I think that creates that connection, and perhaps this work is really operating on that level.
Yeah.
But this is the strongest for me, the connection. Like, it's almost, because like, it reminds me so much of the makeup smear. Like, to me, it's not painting, it's drawing, you know, and there's these gestures. And it's to me, it's like the picking up of the stuff on the floor and putting it onto the wall in just a graphic way, in this gestural way. Like, it's just a different.
There's something about missing the performative act with those makeup works that I really enjoy, that I don't get you so much. Just to pick up on your the word passive, there's a problem I have here, and it's maybe it's a missed opportunity that when the viewer sort of takes in the light, takes in the natural light, pink light, reflective surface, tries to perhaps jostle with all these varying conditions. They walk closer to the gash, and it's almost like there's a narrative sort of consummation at the end of it. And it just feels like it's an escape hatch that the viewer could work harder at trying to make some type of sense out of these quite varied conditions and materials. It feels like you've just given them the candy.
The money shot.
But then what happens when they turn around? Do they still have the candy? Because it doesn't.
They turn around and they come to the office and say, how can I get in there?
That's the money shot.
Is there a ring sheet?
It's your name on the door.
You know what I mean? It's like, there's so much in that cut that says that.
Yeah, I don't know.
I don't want anything back there. I don't want you to be there.
But you also know how we grappled with that sort of object as well, in terms of its placement, whether it actually existed in the work at all, because it was going to be removed, or whether it was a bridging point or a payoff or whatever it was, it was always conditional.
Yeah, it was grappled with a lot before that cut.
Yeah.
Once that cut happened, it rendered that object in a very different way.
Yeah, but then you'll have someone like Lou Hubbard, who opposes the cut.
Oh, but take it out.
But vainly. And leave sort of the edge of the object coming through the other side. because of sort of this line that traces around the space now from sort of one side to the other. But that was always going to be the fucker within the show, and we talked about that a lot in terms of how do we disrupt the condition that was existing in the world.
Or do we keep that refinement? You know, do we keep that edge? Mm. And do we keep that reductivity? Or do we push where potentially it's going to go? It's going to go to that space of heightened theatricality and over the top. I think in the end you made that decision to do that. And once you do, you can't go back. But there's something in that action that's really important.
Well, it could be for them to look through and, there's nothing to see here, or there's something just in the corner. You kind of expect it.
But it's right in the centre of it. It's not
like a lot of people are actually guilty by the time they're walking right up. They know they're going to look through.
And then
it's like they don't want to see something.
But what does the object actually offer them? I think it's a kind of end point by any means. I think that
no, but it bounces still, back to that wall.
It offers them something to look at. Offers them a focus.
I think it actually offers them a problem.
Yes, like, absolutely.
For me, it's a problem.
Yeah.
And by engaging, by entering into that sort of this sort of scopic regime of having to look. It's like there's a mountain, so you have to climb it. There's a hole, so I have to look or penetrate.
I see what they want me to say.
Yeah. It is. This is the navigator. This is the map. But it doesn't provide a solution to the action. It actually problematizes that point of contact.
Absolutely.
Because it throws it back to this.
Yeah, but that.
Because it plays with the exact same.
It's material surface, like the mirror ball.
But it's also. But it
starts to talk about this again.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. But also that position of the tip and the angle and the sort of idea of the prop.
But also that sense that there's two objects pressing on these edges. Works going like that. So in a way, no wonder people feel lost in it.
Because this is
nowhere. You know, like it's about that kind of push out.
But what I'm saying, as this discussion goes on, and the sort of trying to unravel some of the conditions of what we spoke about in constructing the work, and it's interesting in terms of because the work was always, not always, but there was a kind of foundation point of this sort of arc within the space, this sort of shape, the invisible shape. And what's interesting, and whether that was something that was like a type of horizon point within the gallery or as a concept, or whether we did gas sort of that way through the walls. What's interesting is that there's a type of conceptual act now within this body where the action of the viewer, I think, is a type of rotation, this oscillation again between one and the other, this back and forth, this arcing, like a world in art, which is this sort of between two surfaces. It's some,
yeah.
I mean, maybe we achieve that and actually realise it as an idea.
I mean, there's something you said, Kate, like I think it brings an energy and a statement and a sense of action to the space that isn't present in any of the other objects, and without it, the show would feel, I mean, we can project about all the different kinds of show this could have been, but I think it brings, as you said, a really key and important other set of kind of inferences.
It's got a narrative sort of element to it, doesn't it?
But even as well as that sensuality, there's a sensation of sensuality. I mean, it's quite graphic, it's true, but when you get close to it, it's like you get inside that wall and the light starts to move. And I think there's something that visceral sense, it's more than just pink.
And there is
the
also
colour has an experience of colour. It's a kind of crushing, like a crush.
And there's something about those, you know, these rendered very slick surfaces and a combination of reflection and, you know, flatness of surface that this kind of, you know, it's a nice kind of conceptual addition that even if you set up a space that was about clean surface with the promise or the indication of something on the other side of the wall, even if you do something radical and violent or, you know, physical to the wall to get through, you're still left with, or you still encounter reflection and smooth surface on the other side. So there's that sense that you kind of, as you say, you kind of give someone what they want potentially, and you're thinking about that in terms of the pole on the other side. Well, if you think about it, if you couldn't see the pole, but you could see these surfaces and you wanted to get through the surface, well, you've done that, but you're still confronted with these other voids or planes that you again can't get to or through or beyond.
Yeah, I guess so. But you can also read it as a loop, as a throwback to this surface. Which you could construe that as an almost a summary act to try and throw us back in an echoing fashion to emphasise oscillation. So you could say that is trying to perhaps emphasise a condition that doesn't really occur, which is, well, we're not really given any type of resolution to that oscillation. But for me, when I look at
it, but that's also design too.
And that object, these are purely instinctive thoughts. The materiality of that object throws me straight back to what I looked at just before I looked into there, which was that. And I just get this sense, that is the artist's anxiety there to emphasise that echo, that loop, that going back, whereas there's so much pulled apart between that sometimes I feel like it would be nice to just sit with that problem. Mm. It's held in perpetual abeyance.
Yeah, but maybe that's what want is, as you say, that's what desire is.
It's right
in that little limbo ground where you're just going push.
And that's right.
Maybe these are really rich, they're all really rich sort of positions.
It's so restrained that the work kind of.
Yeah.
No, it suffocates and it kind of becomes cerebral almost. Mm. And I think there's something about a kind of an attack that's evidenced in that gash, within the whole work that pulls it out of this kind of something that's a little bit too mannered or a little bit too restrained, in that kind of a seamless kind of work or seamless or a holistic experience that I really enjoy
every time
I come back in here. And but I also want to go back to Terry's moment. I remember Terry's moment just
Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock.
Remember the world.
My father, who was just on the verge of a kind of
collapse.
Everybody around.
We're
thinking
of
this,
and we're faced that bitter stick. He's like, oh, well, I come here, and it's like, this is my life, and I've dropped into this void, and things have been tragic, and then I'm looking for possibility, and I go over here, and I feel like this could be my way out, or another life. And then I look through, and I'm met with the bitter stick, and it's like, I realise there's no fucking place to go. This thing is still holding me. It's a different form, but it's an affront. Mm. You know, it's a challenge, and it's like,
but it's a trap.
It's not an option.
Yeah, it is a trap.
Mm. It's an entrapment.
When he goes there and he looks, I don't feel like I need to go and look again. I just feel like I want to look again. I don't feel like when I come in, you know, coming a few times, like, do you go and look through there again, or if you looked and you don't look again?
I look and I think. No, I don't.
Yeah. It's,
you know what I'm saying? Everyone walks around trying to get back there.
Yeah.
But maybe that's just
a
default position.
Yeah. Maybe. Yeah. I know what's going on through there, and I've had a peek, and I'm not going to go up again.
But it is, I mean, I don't think it's like sort of as tantalising as a peep show. Where you put in your 20 cents and the screen goes up. But we did talk about that.
Yeah, initially we were thinking of having, you know, performance.
Yeah.
And every time we try to think about, well, what would they be doing?
Yeah. But we, and we talked about
all,
laying on the ground, just standing.
Smoking a cigarette.
Yeah, drinking, you know, sort of
smoking.
Having a bar behind it. But I think
walking around the corner and back again.
Yeah,
where we get them from, I'll pick them up on Smith Street.
Yes! Yeah. Like, they're already there. Their ghosts are in there, I promise you. You've been tracked up.
But it's a sense of. I think. I never knew, and I still don't know what that object is or was.
You have to
talk about it. But I suppose it's. Although it's not, I don't think it's symbolic, but it's a compression point of everything, I think, within the show where it. Again, this sort of idea of an echo of where it takes the conditions of what's on the other side. And I suppose refocuses it, but doesn't emulate it, but it problematizes it, I think, as an object. Because it takes a condition of a spatial experience and turns it sort of into a dumb logic and sort of stands there as a sort of dumb idea.
Yeah, but it's guarding it. It's a senital. It's like sitting there going, no, you don't. Yeah. Right back at you. You know, it's not dumb.
It's really erect in relationship to that.
It pushes you back.
And it's like
quite
it's
severely
to a structural permanent within space.
Yeah,
it's not passive at all. It's really
no, I don't think it's passive. But there's a type of like dumbness in what it is.
It's a futility.
Yeah. Like it, because it plays so perfectly off materially in terms of the soft to the hard to the type of large format tile here to the small format tile there and the angles of the prop and the push against the two conditions of the space. But I don't know how many people read it in those terms, or whether they just read it as this thing, disco stick.
Yeah, but I think subliminally if they do. I mean, that's the thing. Yeah. I don't think you actually commentize everything when you're walking in, but it's the same space but heightened back there, and something vicious has happened, and this is like the latent version or the aftermath that sort of collapsed after that or something. You know what I mean? It could, but they do definitely combine, even if it's not like, well, that's reflecting that, and therefore I'm kicked back. You know, it's happening much faster.
But I think that reference to this idea of it being kind of done in some ways too is partly the experience of it being made.
Mm-hmm.
It was in processing the space the whole time we're installing, and often we would be sitting around just trying to figure out the work. And Steve's partner, Jeanette, was just like methodically timing this piece, you know.
Inside.
But we were talking about like, is that the Chinese factory or something? It's like someone there, like slave labor, doing this thing while we're trying to go, what is it?
Oh, you're going, do we even need it?
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And then it's like, I have to keep doing this, but you might want to consider whether you're going to use it.
Yeah, sure.
I'll keep doing that. Like, we don't know whether we're going to use it. Please keep
smiling. I'm saying. So Jeanette exits the stage, and then it becomes a jousting stick. All of a sudden, this thing becomes active, and it's going everywhere.
Floor, I was like, what is that? I felt like for so long it was a foil, and that it was never going to be used. But then it actually became. It made sense at some point.
Well, I think it made sense when we started activating it or playing with it, when you put it up above those two walls in the corner, and it sort of became a bridge, a split.
Mm-hmm.
And I think once that activation happened, when we handled it as such, then it no longer became, because in one sense, like many things within this show, and I think for me it was always part of the problem of the show,
mm-hmm.
was the way things were made or deferred, because we never had time or whatever, so other people were manufacturing. And even that object was being manufactured in front of our eyes for us, like, and we just sort of watched it sort of happen. But it was the same. Sorry?
You were doing other things.
Yeah, I know, but it's the same. It was the same as, like, with the plug, where. Both things, and the walls and the glass, it wasn't until we engaged with them that they became real.
Yeah. But it's an interesting thing
that they became active.
That process and what it is as collaborators, what you're actually materially working with, mm-hmm. when everyone else, as you say, though it's not entirely true, but when everyone else is dealing with physical materials, well, what is it that you are in fact doing and sculpting and formulating and setting into train if all those things are actors within what it is you're making?
Mm.
And then that takes us straight back to these, you know, all the entry points we started talking about, you know, zonal and plane and you know, space, but just how things oscillate. And that they seem to oscillate around really specific objects or clusters of symbols that are scattered in different places, but that they're arranged, the arrangement or the position of them in space allows them to, you know, create something that requires navigation and unpicking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. And within that comes this sort of spectre of stylization. Like if we do stand back in this situation and things occur, mm-hmm. then things can become sort of surfaces and pastiches, and things can become about the way they look. You know, that old sort of disjunction of something stylized that can't accommodate substance somehow.
But that was a real point of inquiry for us, because so many stages were thinking, are we just creating an alien's disco? How do we get past your gay porn and why? What's going on? This alter ego coming out between
it was. It's
us. Then grappling with, well, how does it move beyond that? What are the triggers that allow it to become that but something else? It's drawing
And what is this aesthetic that we're building between black glass, black wall, hot pink, the cart, the slash?
Or going in further collaboration.
But that's what I meant by writ large. Like, it's like your practice up here. You know, it just becomes something else, and this like small sort of interaction with the wall becomes this giant thing with the chainsaw, where you're directing it back here and you're cutting it, and, you know, so it becomes it's like this huge version of your practice that sort of runs away from you in some ways, where this tension of desire becomes something that becomes unwielding, you know, and what is that? And then, oh, we've created a monster together. And
it's also interesting in terms of scale, the scale in relation to the viewer. Everything is bigger than the viewer as well, which is why there's that sense of coming in and situating yourself in these bigger planes with bigger objects and bigger gestures and all those things, you know. It's all of a sudden, it might be talking about the domestic, but it's much bigger than the domestic, or it might be talking about an act, but it's much bigger than an act, you know.
And it's not a person that's gone through that wall.
No.
You know? Something else entirely. Yeah. And both of the objects, going back to that whole idea of that being dumb object, both of them are futile, because they don't, you know, if it has the potential to oscillate around the room, it's not going to, can't do that. It's sort of, as you say, flaccid and latent, and the same with that. This is, you know, it's put in the position of a support structure, but it's clearly not supporting anything. And so they're sort of put in these positions where they can't actually do what they're intended to do, or what their form is intending, but the materiality is subverting.
They can't feel, I suppose, a type of inherent nature. Like, in terms of what that could be, it's so useless and flaccid that it will always...
But it has the potential to be really violent. I mean,
it
could be the thing that actually made that mark.
Which we talked about.
But it doesn't, you know, can't possibly be. And so it's this...
And say it's that as a prop or a type of ballast point, which can hold nothing because it's on point. So it's...
Yes, look at these pointers in a way. But, you know, what are we caught in? What are we missing? You know, are we caught in the graphic? Are we caught in the pictorial? You know, are we caught in the style of certain things? In the style of design? In the style of violence? It's a violent act to me. As you said, it's a graphic act. It's a pictorial act. And, you know, maybe that's what's missing. And perhaps that's what's quite pertinent as well.
Yeah, it's the imagination that comes into play. As I was saying before, it's the imagination that makes the work for me. It's what happens in the middle of the space.
But it could also be the thing that's not quite taking it into... It's not allowing enough of intent to come through. Could be a lack of, you know, intent. And in a way... It was not guided, this show, by a kind of intent.
I don't think.
It was circumnavigating it the whole time, and then it started to find. We started to find positions for things, a way to activate things. I don't think we ever trying to address a question.
Sure.
In our statement, we tried to address the question, but in the work. I think it was actually very instinctive, but mostly spent a lot of time just, you know, trying to figure out what it is we were doing, what the purpose of the work.
Yeah, and each thing was a response to the thing before.
But it was so held in process, I don't think we could really conceptualise.
I think that's what collaborations are, though. You know, honestly, I think that's what they are. It's what they do. That you feel your way until it comes to a point where it makes sense with the objects in play, or you, create things together, and it's just like, okay, where does this fit? And oh, this actually needs to be a different size, or this needs to be over here, or whatever. And it's this constant shifting back, and it doesn't exist until you put a timeline on it and go, well, this is when it has to stop, because the collaborative process continues, and it so happens that you've got to have a show before it. It's got to stop, but there's no resolution to a collaboration. There's hardly a resolution to your own practice. How can there possibly be to two artists coming together with different processes?
And that's true, because it's
so I don't think that there's anything wrong with this questioning or this unknown. Coming back to that point, I think that's actually great. I don't see that as a bad thing, or that you didn't know what it was, or you still don't know what it is, or,
it's
you know, that
they just... It's very different to a curatorial, you know, premise, which is liberating.
But you're the curators. I mean, that's what I was thinking before. You've got these elements, you've got other people making it, who bring it into the space, and you're the ones that are saying, this work goes here, and this work goes here, and there's this negotiation going on.
The difference is that most curators would then... You know, it would be that they would be, these things would be based around some kind of essay or text or some kind of, you know, not explanatory, but like something that, you know, in a kind of very direct form kind of talks about all the things that are operating, whereas this, the way they operate in relation to one another, they all very much embody the things that they, you know, the way, the styles or the way you look at it. But there's so many different things that those operating in, so many different collections of tight-knit, realised, conceptual frameworks floating around that your, as you said by the beginning, your relationship to them determines how they operate at that point in time.
Mm.
Whereas curatorially, people often don't approach, very rarely approach things from that practice space.
I'm thinking of like what I'm doing at the moment with Meredith Turnbull, and it's all of us in the space, and that's exactly what we're doing, you know. And so maybe I feel like that a curatorial relationship can actually be much more generative and much more supportive of the process of making, as opposed to...
Than it is normally?
I don't know. I mean, you know, there's other ways and ways. It's like the difference between mentoring and three square. What is mentoring? You know, what is curating? There's other ways of doing it that it doesn't have to be, this is my version, we'll stick to this. You know, and so when I say that you are curating the space, I'm saying that, yes, that is a process-based, freeing thing, not a, like, well, I've got this list and it will adhere to this. And I've already written the essay before the show exists, you know.
But the interesting thing to know, too, is that Stephen and I both couldn't commit to writing a text to go with this work.
Much to my chagrin.
We know. We weren't trying to be belligerent about...
It's not about me, it's about people's expectations.
Yeah,
it's really difficult to market a show.
But
most people won't come anyway, they just want to read about it.
Yeah, but we felt false doing that.
I think we would have hedged the show in, and I think both of us being, I suppose, in the place we are with work, it would have done nothing for the work or for us or for the viewer, really, except for trying to illustrate something that potentially doesn't exist anyway. Just to satisfy, again, another expectation that we really weren't interested in, I suppose, that part of the dialogue with the work, when the work still felt so in flux in many ways. And I think...
But writing doesn't have to nail it either.
No,
I know, but even in terms of as any form of discursive point of text,
however, like Jeanette should have written the essay.
Sorry.
Jeanette should have written the essay.
Yeah, she should have
written. You know what I mean? And so it comes from a different point, a different version of what it is and where it goes. And it doesn't have to be coming in on top of it. It can come from underneath it.
But even that time, and even after that time, we didn't really want
No, words are hard without anyway.
It's partly also because we're both working in a context where we're constantly delivering a critique.
Constantly but trying to
use
language.
This was a space to ensure it not to be that, and we're really so desperate for it in some way.
And I think that comes back to the point for me where the most meaningful point of the work is that viscerality, the encounter, that sort of, again, this sort of dumb moment when you stand within an artwork or before an artwork, and it's just you and it. And that, again, that way of moving yourself around and through conceptually, mentally, emotionally, kicking it or questioning it or being curious. And I think...
And then people come back and they try to find the
handout. Yeah.
Have you said
that? But I think...
And then they go, oh.
And but I think that was actually an important point for me, was to not even give them that option to validate the experience to objectify it or mediate it through somebody else, but to say it doesn't matter whatever the experience was or what your take on it is, that's what you're leaving with. And we're not going to shape that in a or skew that, or I don't know. It's, and I was also amazed from sitting the show the amount of times people came back, like multiple visits.
I just had to come back and see it without.
Because
it in it.
Well, they left it.
That you would, which is like, oh, I just needed to know.
Yeah, it's almost like it's that thing where they weren't satisfied the first time, or it was too puzzling, or whatever, that they came back. I bought somebody else with me to say, you try and work it out. I think was quite funny.
I think the opening night, I mean, I can imagine it being so different. To have one person be bouncing around. Yeah, exactly. But it would have become something
real. With that side of the work, or with that side of the work.
Or you're just like walking back and forth going, nah, I just want to do this, I want to change
it.
I want to
make it mine. And then
I think that's a connection with them.
That's right. And Stephen having a few drinks and being on the defence. So
yeah.
That was a classic.
But you also challenged one of the works in that show. Remember when you said about Sammy's work? Oh, anyone can take a photograph of a house in So Sammy was like ready for a fight by the time she arrived.
I kept looking at the image that you sent with the font. I kept thinking it's more about sort of the matter though, there is about the void.
Yeah.
You know, the whole sort of the and the capitalization that is everything about it. I think that for me, sort of nailed it. There's nothing, but then it's a big, quite theatrical ask in that nothingness.
Mm.
And I find that a very intriguing way to sort of pull down that received history of.
Are you talking about the missing, like the void, or are you talking about missing, like the missing bit?
Well,
I'm talking about the missing as in the whole sort of received history of the void in relation to a horror movie, the title of it, the missing and the howling. It's sort of got that ambiguous connotation to it. This is emptiness writ in a...
Lurid.
Almost, lurid, I was going to say almost hysterical.
But in a way, to not go too Lacanian, but, it is the missing. If the missing is the lack, and lack is desire, and this is desire, then it is the missing. Object and the, object petiar and the drive and the attempt at resolution, this is actually... of that in many ways.
I'd agree with that, except it's a style of desire, not desire.
Well, no, it is very stylized design, but it's also, we live in an age of stylized design.
I was going to say, it doesn't mean it doesn't work.
I think the desire has become so satisfied.
But that's right, that's what I mean before, by its relevance. Yeah. And then you take on stylization, it starts to give it a particular sort of turbulence.
And it means that many of the disparate objects or different approaches or oscillating things or whatever we've described them can operate in a way that someone is still finding their way with them, working out what it means or whatever, but they understand that they're all, as I said earlier, that they're all speaking a language that is the same language and that the same, in the same tone as one another, but they're kind of saying different things, So there is a stylization in terms of like pulling into the, say 80s gay disco thing to touch on that again, but it's something that there's the framework that allows you then to leave open what mass, like ambiguity, So one can navigate something. Rather than just feeling like they're completely disparate things that only operate on an intellectual level rather than
There's no generosity, in other words, where there actually is.
Yeah, it's not like Jenny Holmes' statement, take me from what I want, which again is a sort of language of desire, but it's a sort of disingenuous phrasing of that because it's in terms of the language of subjectivity and the other, where this isn't about that, it actually is dumping all of that back into, I think, the contemporary zone of what desire is and what materiality means to us today, both in terms of art and architecture and interior architecture and design.
And image.
Yeah. I think there's an interesting play with that, and it's interesting in the documentation and the photographs of that. That's where it actually, for me, becomes even more hyper. When I saw Matthew's images, seriously, it's torn.
Yeah.
It's like
you can see every pore in the skin.
Yeah, it is. And I was so shocked by them. Because it's even more hyper than I can experience. I didn't know what to do with them because it's like. It's like looking at pores in skin.
Should you shoot behind the wall? Is it sort of ethical to put those images of the space where people couldn't actually enter? Then I saw the images themselves, that question just became completely dumb. The whole shoot just elevated the installation to such a fantastical experience.
Because we always said beforehand, this will document beautiful. We always knew it would document well.
Yeah.
But when those photos came through from Matthew, it was just like...
I haven't even heard your response.
I know. When you sent the images through and said, please respond, I actually didn't know what to say. It was just poor.
I'm quietly trying to say to Megan, we only use the lighting in the show.
Yeah.
I'm dragging an arsenal of lights up as
it
goes.
Yeah, it was.
But he does push it.
Yeah.
But I enjoyed that about the images.
Well, it is.
I think the afterlife of the show is going to be as fascinating as the last 4 weeks.
But it's funny because I said the image out, I would have sent it to you guys as well.
I just got that one.
Yeah. It's one of them. It's like on the Saturday after the Friday, I sent it out to quite a few people. Every one of those people turned up on that Saturday. Mm. Just go, I need to know what this is.
I need to reconcile.
Yeah. I know, they are
full on. They're beautiful.
They're seductive. They almost bring down the essence of it because it erases the space in a way that this can't.
Mm.
And so it brings it down to just the bits that you're actually interacting with,
mm-hmm.
that allows this void
mm-hmm.
to fuck off. So all that problem disappears.
But this is the art bit.
Yeah,
I mean, that's the documentation.
Yeah, totally, but you actually get to see space is to work fundamentally
in so many ways that the edge of that wall to the edge of that wall and those two walls is really so much of the work.
Totally.
And
but I knew that before because I was thinking.
But it's the stuff that won't.
I feel like I'm in the painting department making an installation. I can see that this is going to photograph.
Mm.
There's so many painters when they approach installation, they're always thinking pictorially before the work's even been made. So it always comes up well in the photograph. So some really problematic or, you know, when work's often engaged in a different way experientially, you can never capture that experience in any way. You can't capture this either. There's something about being able to deal with pictorial in this work photographically that makes those images amp up the pornographic.
Mm.
I think you could, but it would be so looming, in the same way that that's so looming, that no man's land would be so looming, it would just be devastating, you know what I mean? As an image, I don't think, you know, so that it would just become hyper again, but there's this empty space before you get to that bit.
Mm.
It would be hyper in the same way that the image is hyper.
Mm. This sort of bookending in what I call elasticising of the space is interesting in relation to heavy as well.
Mm.
How dense the first few metres of the space were, and then how they used the swim wall as what they called a runway, which was a navigational device. It's nothing else.
But
and there were obviously, you know, two sculptures that we sort of had to sort of encounter, navigate, and walk around before we got into another sort of dense area down the rear of the space.
Just a kind of gentleness to the way you encounter that show where there's a little abruptness. Here, and I think the abruptness here, what I enjoy about it being situated in a kind of book, I really see that here in terms of response to the space.
You really
I really,
or
rarely have seen that in terms of a response to this space through the shows that have been there, just that kind of slam.
Mm.
It's not a space that inspires that in some ways, but activated it quite intentionally as a kind of reaction to the slight edging of that wall.
I mean, that's quite a forceful gesture.
Yeah.
Filling that cracker. Well, you've frozen it.
Yeah, yeah. No, but it was with the,
you know, that is dangerous.
This little gesture is still here. Try as you might.
That is the
it's
only
still
thing
here.
That can keep.
Look at that crack.
You know, that crack is like the fulcrum of a text that keeps getting rewritten.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've denied that.
We were very good.
That's one of the 30 things. Almost aggressive mode, actually.
But it's only a new crack, really.
No, I think it's only aggressive if it's your gallery.
Yeah.
It's only you.
A lot of people.
I don't mind that.
A lot of people see the way that that's used in various exhibitions.
Yeah, yeah, I think it was one of the things that it was almost the first thing we decided to do. Was to actually try and fill that small void. Although we didn't do it till late, we always knew we wanted a singular surface.
Mm.
And that was too much of a disruption it made that binary even more distinctive because it actually put a split, as the floor does.
And
as the bulkhead does, but that actually reinforced it, like, on the wall. And, but it's a thing that when we were making the work and doing the work, we kept on saying, like, I don't think Conical's really seen a show like this before. Like, it forced a condition within the space that I don't know I've seen in Conical sort of history.
Mm.
Not as a type of radical gesture, but as a way of pushing all those things that people have been working with for so many years about Conical so far to some other edge away and bringing everything back to the type of, I suppose, intention within the work, within the space, not the space within the work.
Definitely, yeah.
Which has always been, I think, a type of premise that people have always taken on when they've shown it. And that, I think that's a really interesting, it would be interesting to see in terms of the way people respond to the space, I think, after Heavy and after this. Because being the first two shows,
I think you'll see a lot more work in that vein.
Yeah.
It's a very conscious decision to change the programming once the space became finished.
Yeah.
There's, you know, equally conscious decision to have Bridie in 3 Square with the, actually it wasn't 3 Square so much, but it was definitely Bridie in the left side of the 3 Square.
Yeah, yeah.
To keep, you know, that part of the program, I guess, working in the space with that sort of feel to it. Once this was finished, there was a real, I guess there was a desire to move away from that idea of response.
But you kept the angle wall. This one.
Which angle wall?
Well, the moving wall.
The moving wall.
Yeah, I think, stay tuned, you'll see. What happens next is. You know, I mean, that is a functional device.
Yeah.
It can be a functional device as well as a conceptual device. And it can sort of, it's a sliding scale as to how that's used. Yeah, I think there's been a, you know, the sort of move towards more varied practices. But then we, the consciousness that let's go back to our roots for the first sort of 6 months and then move away again. I agree with you in terms of there's not a lot of precedent for the type of it's almost a denial of certain specific histories. That's assumed.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking about an artist that didn't like the light fittings and made up little MDF covers put the microphone. There's a confidence to eradicate something that's in the way of irritants rather than this as an expressed condition that I must respect it.
There was a funny with the show that I did with Paul Shepherd, there was one of those situations with him though. Do you remember with his prints on the walls, which are along those walls, they were almost exactly the same size as the windows. They were like half a centimetre on every side smaller. So he couldn't hang them over, but they kind of sat where the windows sat. So he, we together, but it was for his part of the work, we sealed up the whole wall. We basically built a false wall in front of the wall, painted the same colour in front of the windows, so we could hang over all the windows except for one work, which didn't hang in the same spot as the window. Which was really, you know, but it kind of, when you walked in, it felt like all of Conical's windows were there, but one of them had been moved.
But it's that
you couldn't tell.
That inability to sort of align.
Yeah.
It always catches people out. And why wouldn't it? You know, what is that, you know, sort of architectonic desire?
The
Why wouldn't the building fight back? Why wouldn't the others fight back?
Yeah. The building fights back plenty. As we all know, having worked in here, but
just working with the plaster, I get a line on the organising of the line on the top of that wall, and then of course, when the wall was being shut, there's this massive hump in the middle of the floor.
Doesn't have to be right, just right.
Well, it's the same as this line here, where there's this massive slump, so all the glass had to be cut so it could keep the line of the floor. Otherwise, it would just get
a couple of weeks ago, I walked downstairs and there was a flash European car parked out the front. Some young Italian guy. We got out and he said, overalls, he had manual automatics. And I immediately recognised the name because that's what this building was called. he said, oh, I'm just, you know, on my way to a meeting in the city, or, you know, with all the car guys or whatever. And I thought I'd just stop by the old building. Anyway, he was telling me, I said, what was that hole in the middle of the floor? I assumed that you stored all the gearboxes up here, because that's when we first saw the gearboxes up here. And you lowered them down below, or you craned them up, whichever way. I said, oh, no, that was a pain in the ass, that thing. We blocked it up and used to throw all the gearboxes down the stairs, lining the stairs with blankets. That trapdoor was actually used by the first owner, who was a butcher, and used to carve the beasts down below and hoist up the legs of, you know, lamb or whatever. The thing was coming out right through the centre. I had this incredible Francis Bacon moment on the street. Just thinking, what a fantastic sort of history. And it's like the whole building is like, life's got oil underneath, oil tanks, wise. Council won't have to do anything with it. Mm. And it's got this sort of history of bovine blood as well. It's quite amazing. Mm. Let alone grafting, you know, trying to graft two buildings sort of together by wrapping it, just as Leon pointed out, that thing wrapping a string on the facade around the two of them to try and cohere them somehow. Mm. Fascinating what they did. Well, no, you couldn't do any of these things. Yeah. Blood, oil, the EPA would be all over you. Yeah. Well.
We take that as a point of departure.
Yeah.
The conversation.
Yeah, interesting. Even the discussions just feels quite different. It's an interesting sort of endpoint of view. How do you guys feel about working together?
I think that was sort of easy in one sense.
We weren't in conflict at any point, really.
No.
We worked our way through everything.
I think that.
But perhaps also that came from being so. Both so stretched at the time.
Mm.
That we almost both had to let go of things. Mm. Like I didn't really feel like I was trying to fight or push or hold a position. You know, I was just trying to float with what was happening and respond. There's forceful, it's surprising actually how much attack the work has, given that the collaboration
was so gentle.
It was very gentle. Yeah.
The collaboration was more, I felt, like an easy discussion around an idea that just kept on evolving, and we just kept on moving with that as it shifted. We never said, let's hold on to that idea, like let's hold on to the performers, or let's hold on to the mirror on the other side of the wall, or let's hold on to this part of the work. As the work sort of unfolded and shifted and moved and came back around, we sort of just kept on going with it.
But I think there was an underlying anxiety that we both felt about not really being able to grasp where it was going and where it was. And I think we both felt that.
Yeah, tremendously. Like it was always elusive.
But we kind of held it.
There were flashes of thrill.
We gave each other that space.
Sort of direction of confidence.
Yeah.
I remember telling you that image I had of, you know, Matisse with his little bamboo stick painting the drawing, the charcoal drawings in the chapel. And was it the walls?
Yeah.
And when you were with the chainsaw, Kate standing back here. I've like almost seen that bamboo stick, and I was thinking, this is an interesting collaboration. Kate's going, no more to the right, to the left, and you're over there as well. She's standing back in. It was a real, real moment in the collaboration.
That was actually
kind of pivotal. It was, and it was like 3 o'clock on Friday.
Yeah,
we're
thinking,
people
are
going to
come and have an asthma attack. Because we couldn't see anything. But that was good. It's good that kind of that happened.
It's just the whole thing just seemed fucking crazy at that point. I was just really
the
water.
Yeah,
what else can we do?
But I reckon the ease with between the two of you comes with trust and comes with a really close friendship, you know. And that allows that ease. And so you just go, we can do this at the last minute, and we'll, you know, I have faith in you. Let's go. Let's do it.
And it's respect, and also I don't doubt Stephen's judgment or decisions, but I'm happy to kind of push it.
Mm. Yeah, the same.
Saying in reverse. So I don't think it comes from a fear of, oh, I'm dealing with someone who doesn't know what they're doing or doesn't have a position or doesn't, you know what I mean? It's like,
or doesn't know me either.
Okay, that's throwing me. Okay, I'll just have to think about it for a while and, yeah.
Yeah, it was. And I think we've both done enough shows over the years to be confident in what we're doing and how, I mean, for the fact that we sacked the glass handler so we could cut it ourselves, never having cut glass before, I think this shows a type of, not bravado, but the level of control we actually understand materials in our process. And I think that was always apparent, and it became more apparent at that point, where it's like, okay, you can go and we'll do this. Leave it to us.
And the quickness of your decision, you know, instead of not wrapping around the glass, leaving it as a plane, you know, how the joints are expressed, or in fact, in this case, you know, not expressed.
No,
all these things were pretty snap.
Yeah,
you know?
Like there was always this discussion around the type of totality of an idea of the whole wall, or the whole space, or one. But as the work keeps moving on, those things are resolved quite quickly in terms of what they become.
There was no recrimination about, oh, I did this, you did that. No, there wasn't. And it was sort of like, or we sort of recognised what we each had to give at a particular time. Mm. We just worked within those limits and let the work be what it was within those limits. Where past experiences have been, the ego is being foregrounded so much more. It just really wasn't.
Well, it wasn't about that.
The undercurrents of operational.
How did you find that time, that sort of 10 days, 12 days or so that you had? I mean, I felt it was such a strange time because, you know, you'd be sort of in and out quickly, and then there'd just be this index with continually being with any sort of flash of it, and you wouldn't be here for 2 days or so. I mean, would it have been...
That's okay, because you hold...
Sure, yeah, I know.
But we were still talking about it when we were out of Monash.
Oh, I'm sure you were, yeah. So, but I wonder if it was like 4 days, how it would have changed the process. And
4 days? If it was 4 days,
But there was something really, well, I guess what I'm saying is there's something really stretched out about it.
Yeah,
it felt like it was going on forever, but then at other times, there were just
like
these snap decisions, and it was an interesting
process. To a different, both of us, and we hold things in the air for as long as possible, which is why that cut happened at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We weren't ready to commit to it before then. Or if we ever were, we didn't know. So we did push it. We were still sweeping up at 5. But that's okay. That's kind of the way that we often do. So I don't think that was a kind of radical thing for either of us.
No, the most radical thing for me was having an object already existing before the show, because I don't work in the, my practice is to turn up into a space and make the work on the side.
But we only turn on Thursday.
But there was a time, it existed already as a wooden form, like it was apparent before we walked in the space, and we'd already made a decision. And for me that was quite a, because it sets up a problem before we even make the condition of the work. It's like, it's almost sets up the problem I have with painting, which is the limitation of the frame. It's where you have an object before you even come to the space. Which for me that was a challenging thing of, oh, we've got this problem. This object, what do we do with it? Yeah, and it's interesting that I'm glad it didn't come until the end almost, because I think if it was here earlier, it would have become even, I think it would have actually changed things quite significantly, because we would have dealt with it differently, where in the end we just had to go, well, there. Because there was no...
It's about half an hour.
Yeah. I thought it took them all like half a day. We kept on pushing
it. That's right, yeah.
We kept on moving it from one side to the other. And,
No, but it was actually very... it's a great experience, but very tough for me in terms of time, energy. Mm. My conflict was elsewhere. It wasn't here. This was like a kind of calm. My conflict was elsewhere. But it was really great to revisit Conical after not showing here for some time. I mean, your other show was...
That was 2 years ago.
2 years ago. So it's relatively recent. Mm. Whereas I haven't really shown you for a number of years, probably. And I've always held this as a space I would come back to, but not quite being ready. Like, there was probably a number of moments
it's where I said, well,
but then I didn't. And that's partly because of the, for me, the strength of the space and what it does in terms of a sense of what can I do there again, like how can I now reinvent that. That always has set up for me a kind of point of resistance and coming back. But this time I felt like I was able to address that at the point of the regeneration of the space, perhaps. I'm not sure, but
yeah,
there's something
probably
happy
to,
for that.
Yes, a lot of people mean about different things when they talk about the space. Some are referring more to sort of programming, other shows, programming history, physical space.
But even within like the show that we were on 2 years ago for the festival, not only does this obviously feel like a different world, because it is, but the space itself. Like, it almost feels unfamiliar in this manifestation, where I can't... I can sort of locate that work 2 years ago, like when I'm standing and looking. But it's almost like a type of... It's not the same space. And it's not... Like, it's quite interesting, this shift.
It's not a new space. It's an altered space.
And
everything's just reused but repositioned.
And it is quite
an intuitive process.
It sort of provides this very strange haze in terms of the shows that preceded, because they can't conform to what the space is anymore.
Yeah, that's a great thing. And there is an ability to try and not completely erase it, but make it a different era.
Yeah, it's sort of there's a type of haze on
it.
Totally. I mean, for Moto, I was thinking that 3-squared was going to have white walls again. So I thought that me responding to the openness was like a one-off interaction. And so to see it again and again and again and refigured, and then it's gets shifted again, when the walls are finished and heavy, and then this. And so it's kind of nice to have that constantly evolving, constantly shifting. And I'm sure the next work will play with the architecture. I mean, that's what, there's hardly any galleries that allow that. And I do really appreciate that, even though you think that you're going against Conical's history, in some ways you're absolutely rewriting it.
No,
of course.
It's not going against the history, it's sort of like where you position position yourself within that, like those types of extremities that have happened to you previously. And the, what is this, a fourth or fifth manifestation of the space?
Oh, I guess a major one would be a fourth, but there's been sort of more pictorial or mental changes.
You can't help yourself, Adrian.
No, it's just how do you make a condition? You know, if you're saying that these conditions are a given, then they have a responsibility to move.
Totally, and I think that because it is a responsive site, and people enjoy activating that history of it being a responsive site, the gallery has to shift. Otherwise, it's just like, here we are again, responding to the same conditions again. And it needs that abrasiveness to...
And that responsive, as we said, is often us to us. As much as it's us to us. There's been so many sort of had to try to recast a site model, flip a site model around somehow. Has got to something more, or that's an interesting direction. Or maybe it's more just want to stop that and be more directed than go someplace else. But I don't know if people are interested anymore. We don't experience things the same way as perhaps we did when we first started this. Maybe we don't need that so much. Different question.
Yeah, but I think that it's where that language of the type of site sponsored or site specific way of working is now the natural language. Where 10 years ago, or 15 years ago, or even maybe 6 years ago, it was conditional, it was systemic. When the artists, generations of artists, younger artists, have grown up with that through their education. It's just normal now. It's not a point of separation or difference to the space. It is the space. It is the world. It's like installation art, or where it just becomes natural language in terms of how we understand and operate within art. So I think it's
true, but I wonder if there's the opportunity to for many artists to really work with that. I wonder if there is.
Not in terms of shifting architecture to this degree, I don't think. I don't think in terms of, there's not that many galleries that allow such major, like, you know, you just polish the floors and then, you know,
video.
A lot of galleries are a lot more precious than that. And you know, it's good to have a space that's not precious.
But having a free space that's a nice space can just be another entry point. All the stuff we're talking about can be completely irrelevant. Oh, okay, so here's a space to show where, you know, we're not being charged and we're getting supported to a certain degree. It's not a contemporary art organisation, it's not a commercial gallery. You know, begs the question, what is it? But that can be a condition as much as, the history of the place.
I don't think you should question everything just because of funding bodies either. Like, I think it's almost like...
But I like to question things amongst like-minded people, because that's the difficulty with the static committee. You just keep getting... Everyone locks into their own sort of opinions about it, and it's very difficult to keep moving on with that.
I think it's really interesting having a space that's... that crosses between emerging artists and more... I don't even know what the word is. What's an art? How long do people emerge for? There's this chrysalis that keeps going forever.
Emerged. Emerged.
Where that comes together and there can be a dialogue of overlapping, which I think is very, very rare. And also that it's not artist run, which shifts it. And there's actually somebody who is at its helm that's engaged. Like really intensely engaged in everything that happens. And that's rare, I think. Because usually it's one or the other. I don't know, when it's in that middle ground, well,
yeah,
where it's not commercial.
It sort of becomes a public space, in a sense, which is different to ARI or to commercial space or to even Gertrude Street as a public funded space. But there's a different discourse that happens both in terms of the artist's relationship to you and the space, but also in terms of the public, I think. Because of there's an expectation, I suppose, in the language of Chronicle over its decade history. How long has it been operating?
Yeah, definitely.
11 years. So it's... Yeah, each one of those manifestations, I suppose, becomes the cornerstone of the next. And anyone, like David, you're saying, the sort of archive or Chronicle, the sort of living memory of every manifestation. And there'll be people out there who equally probably know that as well, who have come month after month, year after year, to all of those shows, who have an investment, both artists and public. And I think that's, I mean, it sounds like I'm talking about legacy, but I'm not, because I don't think you're trying to set that up either.
Now, this is a living entity, will not memorialise itself, so then that's just a real trick, and it's very difficult. It's happened to a lot of spaces, I think.
Well, it's a real trick, especially when, you know, there are those conditions that Brady touched on, which is that it's not a shifting community-run space where there's new direction coming in purely from the fact that some people leave and that new people come in and bring their own desires and ambitions and interests to the core of what the organisation or the space is going to attempt to do or foster. But I also don't think it's about just being a space that's a space and for, you know, an organisation that's a space and it's free, because work is always in the context of the program that it's situated within and presented within. Otherwise, people would just be having shows within, you know, car parks and, you know, empty office space or whatever all the time. And people don't come here just because there's a physical space. There's this program in which, you know, there's this active part of the engagement to it that people who show here get to be immersed in. But there's also just the fact that it is situating a piece and a specific exhibition, but also one's practice within a continuum and a continuum of discussion extensively. So by having a show, one enters into that discussion, and as new people, as emerging artists enter into that, you know, there's an opportunity for them to enter into a discussion that's happening, you know, within a particular language. But one that can be messed with and broken and changed, but that is reflected upon in relation again to what...
It brings us back to the initial discussion about, you know, the territorial relation. And then it becomes... There is a set of directives, but I'm always at least trying to help artists break that, like, through that somehow, you know, the whole history, that which does become a curatorial sort of.
I don't think you should see it as a burden, though, I suppose. I'm hearing you talk about it in a very negative way.
Well, I think it's a burden as a throwing back to the past. That's the only danger that should happen all the time.
But that's sort of part of your whole modus operandi. I mean, that's what you do. That's what this space holds. You love the fact that it's a history container and that you remember every point and what this bit and what that crack means in association with everything. So to annihilate that annihilates Chronicle, you know.
Yeah. So that's surprising to know that I remember the conversations more than the building. But, yeah. Okay, I'm feeling uncomfortable now. We're navel gazing, well, I am, so.
But we were
thank you
at your
name. No, thank you. your generosity in the comments. It's good enough. I've got them there so I can listen to them again.
Yeah.
No, thank you.
It's great. But at the end of every year, I always have a bit of an existential meltdown. But, you know, I think everyone has an obligation to worry. I mean, it's not worry, it's more productive doubt. And I think it's really important. And what's lacking half the time.
But I think Three Squared takes care of a lot of what you're talking about in terms of the next bit and handing over the curatorial premise, because you've got three different people curating in a very short time with young artists coming up. Like, it's breathing new life into it, and a lot of them don't know the history.
Or each iteration with very confident, not only artists, but educators and sort of leaders in their field. And that was fascinating to see how, you know, within a sort of scribe vehicle of authorship, these other authors had complete free rein, and yet they all chose very, you know, specifically to talk about, you know, Chronicles history. And that was not my doings. Anyway, I never get myself out of this movie.
Right. What
could be a trait?
Thanks, everyone. Who didn't know one at the beginning of this present?
The whole thing was, we threw the whole formula out the window.
Yeah, I think we had that.